Azana was stunned, caught almost completely flat-footed, by the size of the blast he'd produced and the simple fact that he'd done so here. Of all the things she had expected him to do, actually starting a fight in broad daylight in the middle of the Firetown street market hadn't been on the list. Even the Agni Kai were usually subtler than that. She backed away, her hands instinctively moving in the circular pattern meant to block and dissipate another firebender's attack. But there was so much of it in this case that she was blown backward, scattering tables, chairs, and frightened fellow diners in all directions. Twisting away from the worst of it, she rolled across the sidewalk, then sprang to her feet. Anne had to admire her aplomb as she batted out a small fire on her right shoulder with a casual flick of her left hand, as if her shirt being aflame were only a minor annoyance. "Sensei!" Anne cried, making as if to dart to her side. "Stay back, Junichan," Azana snapped, holding up a hand. "I don't want you anywhere near this. Leave him to me."
"Listen to the princess, kid," Kaiten agreed, his gold teeth glinting as he bared them in a slightly feral grin.
"Plenty of time for us to get acquainted later. Better say goodbye if you're gonna, though," he added, tossing their table casually out of his way as he advanced toward Azana. "There ain't gonna be much left to talk to later." He ignored her after that, concentrating all his attention on Azana, and she, in turn, couldn't spare anything for anyone but him. Amped on whatever he had just snorted, presumably this was the new thing he'd been talking about, he was shockingly powerful, able to produce larger, hotter, more sustained blasts of flame than any other firebender Anne had ever seen. That included Azana. In the Major League Bending Arena earlier that week, Anne had seen her generate bolts of fire so hot they seemed to bend the air around them. So concentrated, they had charred the fireproof canvas covering of the playing surface. But she might as well have been throwing snowballs, for all that her best efforts matched up to Kaiten's prodigious output now. The only reasons Azana was able to survive his onslaught at all were her superb training, her exceptional agility, and her iron-clad self-possession. Faced with this terrifyingly powerful berserker of a foe, hemmed in by streams of fire that seemed like they should be coming from giant industrial machinery rather than a human being, she didn't panic. If she had, she would have been undone in moments. She kept her defenses up and tight, all her movements precise and controlled, and put the acrobatic skill she'd learned in the MLB ring to full use. Ducking, dodging, occasionally cleaving his attacks with pinpoint bursts of her own, she showed a physical precision and an understanding of fire itself that were far beyond Kaiten's. Her heart hammering in her chest, Anne tried to think what she could do. Her own pyrokinetic power could occasionally approach something like the intensity Kaiten was wielding here, but only if she all but abandoned any semblance of control over it. If she had attempted to fight his fire with hers on anything like a level field, she could only hope to destroy everything in the vicinity, which, she saw, Kaiten was seriously threatening to do anyway, as he hosed down shop fronts and upper-level windows in his efforts to barbecue his opponent. Telekinesis might do the trick, but could she focus tightly enough on what she was doing with him throwing fire all around like that? She wasn't sure. She'd grown accustomed, over the last couple of years, to being unconcerned about the possibility of getting burned. No normal fire could touch her if she didn't want it to. But this... this was reminding her of what it had felt like to be a child, and understand, for the first time, that this strange and beautiful light was not to be touched. Her hand went automatically to the grip of her sword, but Kuranaikaze wasn't there. As a journeywoman of the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu, Anne was obliged to carry steel everywhere it was allowed, but Third Century Republic City, outside certain green spaces designated for martial arts practice, wasn't one of those places,
and she and Caitlin hadn't bothered investigating the bureaucratic labyrinth to see if there was an exception available. Not when she was only going to be in town a week. It was on their to-do list of preparations for her summer return. Nor had she brought along her bokuto, Toneri Koken, which, even in this situation, would definitely have been a lot better than nothing. Amid her desperate efforts to stay alive, Azana glimpsed her student hovering on the periphery, obviously trying to work out a way in which she could help. Summoning up all her strength, she blocked Kaiten's next attack and counterstruck through it, blasting one of his giant gouts of fire into a diffuse cloud of hot gas and punching her own bolt of yellow-white flame through the middle to take him in the chest. Yelling, he fell back, tearing at the persistent flames as they took hold of his gaudy satin jacket. "That won't hold him for long," Azana told herself, and then she turned and shouted to Anne, "Juniper, stay away from Kaiten!" Spotting the frightened crowd of people back by the cafe entrance, not all of whom had been able to fit into the building, she pointed and went on, "Find a way to get those people out of... Damn!" Kaiten had recovered through the simple expedient of ripping off half his clothes. With his skinny but well-muscled chest bared, dressed only in his baggy zoot trousers and his genie-toed cowboy boots, he looked the part of a real Agni Kai duelist now. The next stream of fire, which Azana barely dodged, roared like a freight train as it splashed against the curbstones and across the sidewalk. The thick stench of molten asphalt rose as the pavement bubbled in its wake. Unhesitating, Anne turned and ran toward the onlookers. "Not through there, this way," she said, pointing up a side alley. "Where the hell are the cops?" she wondered, not a sentiment she was accustomed to feeling, as she did her best to master people's panic and hustle them out of harm's way. A couple of the other people in the crowd were firebenders. This was Firetown, after all, and she corralled them as the rest of the civilians lit out for the safety of the next street over. "Come with me," she said. "Are you crazy, kid?" demanded one of them, a young man in less gaudy clothes than Kaiten's had been, but still bearing obvious hallmarks of a certain streetwise style. "That guy's on Comet. I'm not going anywhere near that." "Seriously," said the other, a woman of about 30 who looked like she might be a shopkeeper. "He's an Agni Kai. They're nuts anyway, but, well, look at him." "We're not going to go fight him," Anne snapped, frustrated. "Look at what he's doing to the street. If someone doesn't do something about the fires he's starting, this whole block is going to burn down." When that got her only blank, "So what are we supposed to do about it?" looks, she resisted an urge to facepalm and shouted, "Are you firebenders or aren't you?" Then, with a "fine the hell with you then" wave, she turned and headed back toward the edge of the battle zone. By this time, several of the building's facades had started to catch, with the intensity and volume of fire Kaiten was throwing around, and the abandon with which he was doing it, there was no way it could have been avoided. Anne stopped about halfway to the epicenter, far enough back that she was reasonably sure she was out of direct danger, and centered herself, concentrating. "Focus. Breath. Control," she thought, drawing on lessons she'd learned from both Caitlin and Azana, and, in her way, from Azalin Dvirnatoshkin, who had indirectly taught her the first vestiges of control over her gift's more explosive manifestations as well. Then, moving to the firebending starting stance Korra had first shown her, she reached out with every metaphysical faculty she had at her disposal to get hold of the stray fires, keep them from spreading, start drawing them down. At first, she didn't think it was going to work. Then, when it started to, her first thrill of accomplishment was immediately muted by the return of an old foe she had thought vanquished. Doing it like this, effectively running fire in reverse, she could feel that first ticklish knot of pain start to form, just behind the bridge of her nose. The pain that had always come in the days before she had known how to live with her gift, when it had been more of a curse. In those days, every now and then, the pain would build over the course of a day or three, until Anne's whole head was pounding like one of those giant Japanese drums, until she could think of absolutely nothing else, until she was literally blind with it, until eventually her endurance would fail and, with a sharp spike of even greater agony, it would all come screaming out, destroying everything around her, and leave her a pale and shuddering wreck. A deep, reflexive terror of ever experiencing that again grabbed her guts and twisted at the first twinge, but she gritted her teeth and pushed it away. "You are not my master," she told it sternly. "I am yours. We are doing this now. We have to." Behind her, the two firebenders stared in awe at the foreign girl who had shouted at them. She stood in a recognizable firebending stance, but unmoving. And for a few moments it seemed like she wasn't doing anything. But then, incredibly, the wild flames tearing at the storefronts around her began to cool and die down. A few of the spot fires went out altogether. Unfortunately, the raging battle at the other end of the block was always making more, as bolts and streams and sheets of fire burst uncontrollably out, virtually all from Kaiten's increasingly frenzied attacks, and involved new patches of the streetscape. The girl started moving now, using more readily obvious firebending techniques to pull the new fires toward her, break them apart, weaken them any way she could. The punk looked at the shopkeeper, who looked back at him with a virtually identical look of amazement. Then, without exchanging a word, they turned and ran toward the foreigner, taking up positions to either side of her and applying the same methods. At the far end, Azana found her task getting easier and harder at the same time. Easier because Kaiten was clearly losing control of himself. He'd become almost completely unintelligible now, ranting about something to do with firebender superiority and his own invincibility, and how no one was ever going to stop the Agni Kai. His attacks were growing increasingly wild, without anything like finesse or technique about them. On the other hand, he seemed to be getting even more powerful, if such a thing were even conceivable, in direct proportion to his loss of coherence, and she was tiring. Soon they would reach a tipping point, where his sheer power and her fatigue crossed over, and she could no longer rely on her disciplined defenses and superior mobility to hold him at bay. "Where are the police?" Azana wondered, but she decided it didn't really matter. The metalbenders would be virtually useless in this situation. Karana maintained that they were virtually useless in any situation, but Azana suspected that was a waterbender thing. And any of the few firebenders on the force would be just as outmatched as she was. What she really needed, she decided, was, ironically enough, the fire department. A dozen waterbenders with a tanker would sort this out in a hurry. Or one big lad with a fireman's axe if you were crazy enough. As it happened, the police had arrived by this point, but, like the people Anne had appealed to for help, they had taken one look at the situation and decided there was no way they were getting involved in that action. They concentrated instead on maintaining a cordon so no one would blunder into the middle of the chaos unawares, evacuating the buildings in the area, and generally securing the scene while they waited for reinforcements. Lots of reinforcements. Karana and Pabu emerged from the Firetown North subway station, unaware that anything out of the ordinary was going on. She suspected that Azana and her student would be getting lunch someplace in Firetown Market. Azana had told her the previous evening that they probably would, and she hoped to catch them there. If not, her backup plan was to grab a quick bite herself, then head for the academy and hang around until they were ready for dinner.
"Hold it," a metalbender cop told her, blocking her way at the top of the stairs.
"This area is off limits right now. Disturbance in progress."
"What kind of disturbance?" Karana asked, interest piqued.
"Maybe I can help," she added, showing him her Fire Ferret's challenge coin.
Major League bending teams, of course, had no particular civil defense or law enforcement powers, but everyone in Republic City knew that the Fire Ferrets were the Avatar's team, and that tended to give them a certain quasi-official status at moments like this. The cop was very young, probably younger than Karana herself, and consequently hadn't been on the job very long. He frowned at the coin as if not sure what to make of it, then said,
I doubt it. We're not sure what's going on over there, but, it's pretty crazy stuff. We're waiting for special detail. Or Avatar Korra. You don't happen to know where she is?"
"We all have to be together for that to work," Karana said seriously. "Only by all our powers combined can we summon the Avatar."
The cop blinked.
"Really?"
Karana snorted.
"No," she said. "Don't be a dope." She came the rest of the way up the stairs and looked around him.
"So what's the big emer—"
She trailed off, peering down the street, trying to make sense of what was going on down there. Two people fighting, that much was clear. Both of them firebenders, by the looks of things. But one of them was throwing way more fire than any single firebender, apart from maybe Korra on a serious, serious tear, should have been able to come up with. And the other...
"Azana!"
Karana cried, her sky-blue eyes going wide with dismay. Shoving the cop out of her way, she bolted down the street toward the fight. He yelled for her to stop, and considered cabling her back, but decided that if he did that, she'd probably clobber him. And besides, she was a fire ferret. They had to know what they were doing, right? Halfway there, she came upon Anne and a pair of civilians, doggedly trying to cope with the ever-shifting constellation of collateral fires the furious battle at the end of the block was causing. At the sight of her, Anne cried,
"Karana, am I glad to see you. Give us a hand with these fires."
"But,
Azana," Karana sputtered, gesturing to where her best friend was clearly fighting for her life.
"Look at this place," Anne declared. "You'll never even reach her if we don't get these fires out. Please, Karana. I don't think we can do this by ourselves for much longer."
Karana hesitated for an agonized moment, but only a moment, because she knew the girl was right. Then, her face hardening into a look of determination, she turned and yelled back to the subway station,
"Yo, Bei Fong! Little help here!"
The metalbender cop jogged up, looking puzzled. Karana pointed to the hydrant on the corner.
"Open her up!"
"What?" said the cop, confused. Growling in frustration, Karana grabbed him by the breastplate of his armor and shook him, then kept hold of him with one hand and pointed to the hydrant again with the other.
"Valve! Metal! Bendy bendy!"
Letting him go, she clonked him on top of the helmet.
"Now, son!"
He blinked, then caught on.
"Oh, right, sure," he said.
Turning, he gestured, and the hydrant opened, gushing water out onto the street. Catching it up, Karana was surprised at how hard it pushed back. She'd never actually worked with water main pressures before, being more accustomed to handling water that was static until she put it into motion herself. After one false start, she figured out how to harness its momentum to her own end, whirled a great stream of it into the air, and directed it against the hottest of the hot spots Anne and her colleagues had to contend with. After watching for a couple of moments, the metalbender cop had an idea. Turning toward a nearby alley, he upended a dumpster,
pouring its contents out on the ground, and then dragged it out into the street. Grinning in spite of the situation as she caught his drift, Karana directed water from the hydrant into it, and together, with a discreet boost from Anne's TK, what little of her mental bandwidth she could spare for it, they lifted it into the air and dumped it over the biggest of the collateral fires, summarily snuffing it out. With a rending crash, the facade of the building on the right peeled away from the rest of the structure and fell into the street. The cop slammed the dumpster down beside them for cover, and the rest of the impromptu firefighters jumped behind it as fragments of glass and burning scraps of the shop's awning filled the air around them. Anne nearly lost her concentration as one of the flames licked her cheek, but held grimly on, feeling more and more like she was stuffing 100 pounds of something springy into a 50-pound sack. Crouching next to the dumpster, Karana turned and saw the stony look of suppressed pain on Azana's young student's face. Putting hand on her shoulder, she asked, "Hey, are you okay?" "No," Anne replied, "but I can't let that stop me right now." Karana smiled slightly. She had heard, and said, similar things many times before, and squeezed the girl's shoulder gently. "Right on," she said quietly. Sensing an opportunity to provide a service, Pabu scampered down Karana's arm and around to Anne's other shoulder. "Good boy, Pabu," Karana added, petting first the ferret and then, almost as a matter of course, the girl. Then she raised herself and looked around their makeshift cover. The rubble from the collapsed facade lay strewn across the street, some of it still on fire, all of it forming a jagged barricade between them and the battle still raging at the end of the block. With a frustrated snarl, "So much for getting over there and helping Azana now," Karana turned back to the hydrant. "Good thinking with the dumpster there, Five-O," she said to the cop, as he righted it and got it ready for another load. "What's your name? You guys gotta go back to wearing name tags." "Choose on," the cop replied, a little breathlessly. "Nice to meet you." On the other side of the wreckage, Azana and Kaiten reached the opposite corners of their respective envelopes at virtually the same time. Azana felt her guard break. Pushed to the end of its endurance, her body simply failed her, ceasing to obey her commands with sufficient dispatch. Her timing slipped, then fell away entirely. At the same time, Kaiten was reaching such a pitch of fury that he no longer required anything like proper timing in the first place. It was like he was everywhere, his attacks coming from all directions at once, as if the whole world were filled with nothing but heat and flame and his hate-fueled malevolence. She staggered, beset from all sides, unable to do anything more than keep from being burned to death outright. Eventually, even that ability would desert her, if the shockwaves and pulses of heat didn't finish her off long before he had a chance to burn her flesh. Trying to lunge away from yet another crackling crescent punch, she lost track of where she was and slammed backward into a wall, starbursts of color erupting behind her eyes as the back of her head hit brick. Roaring, Kaiten swept down on her from above, so fully engulfed in his own fire that it was trailing from his very hair. He grounded in front of her, reached out with one hand, and seized her by the throat. His face distorted in a hideous sneer, he drew the other hand back and shaped it into a blade, yellow-orange flame crackling all around it, and held it for a moment before her eyes. "You're done, princess," he said. His voice raspy, but almost conversational, a shock after all the guttural screaming he'd been doing, and he hoisted her off the ground by her throat, slamming her back against the wall behind her again. More explosions of color burst in her vision as she clawed at his hand ineffectually with her own, struggling to breathe. At that moment, with her life beginning to slip from her grasp, Azana achieved a new understanding of a truth she had always taken for granted. She wanted very, very much to live. Tunnel vision began to set in, the blackness creeping in around the edges of her field of view. Kaiten shifted his stance slightly, snickering at her efforts, and Azana's eyes were momentarily blinded by the reflection of the early afternoon sun in an upstairs window across the street. For just a moment she was bathed in the full light of the sun, its heat on her face so gentle and kind compared with the vicious bite of Kaiten's fire, and darkness warred with light in her eyes. As the dazzle filled her world, she felt warmth flowing through her hands, down her spine, to coil at its base like a serpent ready to strike. The little red dragon hatchling, Corwin's daughter's companion, grinning sleepily at her from her nest amid the child's bedding. "Oh, hey, before you leave, you might like this." Color and light, so beautiful, so perfect, so true. And the sun rose inside her. In spite of Kaiten's grip, she drew a deep breath, feeling the fire within blaze up again like a blast furnace. When she let it out, her eyes snapped open, clear and bright once more, and the fire that suddenly wreathed her hands was a clean, incandescent blue, like the flame of an acetylene torch. With one hand she seized the base of Kaiten's thumb at her throat and squeezed. With the other she hauled off and punched him full in the face. Kaiten howled in painful dismay and dropped her, reeling away and flailing as the blue flame lashed him from chest to eyebrows. By the time he was able to dispel it, he had no eyebrows any longer, and the rest of the area had been roasted a delicate red. Shaking his head and blinking, only by throwing up an arm had he saved his eyes, he stumbled back and tried to regroup. Azana lunged away from the wall, the blue flame crackling around her fists and feet, and surged into a renewed counter-offensive. The raw volume of flames she could produce was still nothing like equal to his, but hers were far hotter now. Without any technique to draw upon, he was helpless to protect himself from them. His defense by overwhelming offense availed him little now. Revived by her sudden insight, Azana was back at the peak of her own defensive powers, and her new cerulean firebolts simply blazed right through his own huge but relatively cool and diffuse streams and gouts of flame. With cool precision and superior control, she began to pick him apart. "This isn't right!" Kaiten screamed as Azana broke the back of his floodgate-style assault. "Nobody can beat me! I'm invincible! You can't do this!" Azana said nothing. She had nothing to say. Not to him. Keening with frustration and fear, Kaiten put everything he had left into a single furious stream, a thundering cataract of flame that engulfed Azana completely. Veins bulging, eyes popping, he held it on her for several seconds, pouring all his hatred and disbelief and rage into a torrent of flame that blotted his foe entirely from sight. Seeing the fiery flood approaching, Azana knew she wouldn't be able to avoid it, and that there was far too much of it to counter conventionally. Instead, she reacted by instinct, launching herself into a variation on an airbender's whirlwind kick. This was a maneuver she'd first seen Avatar Korra perform during a demonstration at Bending Camp, the summer when she, Azana, and Karana had both turned 15, when they had first started seriously thinking about taking up sport bending as a professional career. As part of Korra's arsenal, this visually spectacular move combined airbending and firebending to surround her in a spherical shell of hurricane-force wind outside a spinning 6-foot circle of compressed flame. The combination rendered her all but invulnerable for a few seconds while it raced around her, the fire incinerating anything that managed to punch through the wind barrier. Azana's version lacked the outer shell, of course, but the ring of fire formed for her just as it did for the Avatar, and its azure brilliance split and threw aside Kaiten's fountain of flames, leaving her unscathed as it roared past all around her and obliterated the bus stop behind. Kaiten couldn't see that happening. He knew only that she had vanished utterly within the torrent of his last-ditch attack. Finally, unable to sustain the assault any longer, he broke it off and sagged backward, smoke rising from his forearms and hands. Blinking away the dazzle of his own firelight, he looked into the column of smoke rising from the charred surface of the street in front of him, expecting to see nothing remaining of his foe but possibly her shoes. An instant later, Azana burst out of the smoke, streaking toward him like a meteor. Blue fire trailed from her fists. A tight, seething ring of it whirled around her, then burst outward with a firework crack, shedding the last dull sparks of Kaiten's orange flames. Throwing up his hands to protect his face as the wave rocked him back on his heels, he only had time to make a small, disbelieving noise before she was upon him, plowing through his feeble defenses like a brick through a plate-glass window. When her open right palm struck his chest, it felt as if he'd been hit by an artillery shell. Screaming, he went flying across the street to crash into a lamppost, bending it almost double, and rebounded, somehow managing to stay on his feet. Shaking his head, Kaiten staggered toward her, trying to raise his hands, but now his body wouldn't obey, his fuse burned far beyond its limit by the drug and his panic. His eyes clouded again, pupils almost lost in the muddy haze as they opened wide. He blinked at her, looking utterly confused, and then pitched forward and sprawled face down in the street. Azana stood over him for a moment, breathing hard. Then, with the finality of a slamming door, she turned her back on him and walked slowly away, up the street, around the fallen facade. She found Karana and Juniper there, along with a couple of civilians and a metalbender cop she'd never seen before. They were all dirty, sweaty, and weary-looking. Anne, in particular, looked like she'd just fought a battle every bit as grueling as the one Azana had faced. She was drawn, her face white and pinched with pain, eyes reduced to narrow slits. On her shoulder, Pabu looked just short of frantic. Sensing someone's approach, Karana looked up from trying to comfort the young girl. At the sight of Azana, her face broke into a look of delight and relief so profound it nearly hurt to see. Then, turning to Anne, the waterbender said, "Look, she's okay." Azana's apprentice looked up, blinking tears from her narrowed eyes, and smiled wanly.
"Sensei, you're all right," she said.
"More or less," Azana agreed. "What's wrong, Junie-chan? Are you hurt?"
"No, not physically. I just absorbed a little more fire than I probably should have," said Anne.
Seeing that Azana was perplexed by that, she tried to explain, though putting words one in front of the other was a monumental challenge right now.
"Remember the tea? Turns out I can do that the other way around, too. But it hurts."
She put her hands to her head, pressing their heels to her eyes, and said in a voice not far from a whimper,
"It really hurts."
Pabu chirped worriedly and pressed his face to her cheek.
"Can we help you?"
asked Karana, but Anne shook her head.
"No, I need to let it out again. But I can't do that here."
With a wry, crooked smile, despite the pain she was in, she said,
"Not burning down this whole neighborhood was the point of the exercise."
Azana considered that for a second, then smiled slightly herself and took a couple of steps back.
All right, she said. Let it out.
Anne's eyes opened slightly wider.
What?
Let it out, Azana repeated. I'll deal with it.
It doesn't really work that way.
Junichan, said Azana gently. Then, with a mischievous smile, she added, Do you trust me? Certain members of the Republic City Police Department's special detail, approaching the site of the reported disturbance in Firetown by airship, were taken aback to see a column of fire shoot into the sky from the approximate location of the incident, like some kind of bizarre signal flare. So large and strange a display was it that most of them assumed it meant the Avatar was on the scene already. But when they arrived, all they found was an unconscious man in the tattered remains of some expensive pants, a number of deeply bewildered civilians, one slightly shell-shocked patrol division rookie, and three women, and a fire ferret, having the most tearfully relieved group hug any of them could ever remember witnessing. After spending a couple of hours surveying, examining, considering, reflecting upon, and just generally enjoying the sight on Mount Weitang, the party broke up and returned to town by two different routes. Rohan and Corwin ran Rio home on Peavey, then went into the city proper to register the transfer of ownership formally at the Republic City Land Office. Iki, meanwhile, saw Uchna, Anthy, Annabelle, and Garnet safely back to the island on Mogi, though to her glee, Uchna got to drive. Or at least sit there looking like she was in charge, while Mogi found his own way home, which she acknowledged was probably closer to the truth. Having completed their task at City Hall, Corwin and Rohan were having a spot of lunch. Well, Corwin was having lunch, Rohan was having tea. At the nameless sushi joint around the corner when someone approached their table. Rohan noticed her first. Glancing up, he blinked in surprise at her approach, then rose from his seat and said, I'll just go and make certain Peavey is comfortable, before beating a hasty retreat. Rohan? A puzzled Corwin inquired of the space where the airbender had been. Then he looked up and saw the person standing in front of him, and his confusion only deepened. It was Zanya, the firebender from the Frostbite Point Ice Wraiths. A ruthlessly competitive, dirty-fighting professional bender, with whom Corwin had had a difficult time a few days before, while subbing for the Temple Island Fire Ferret's absent regular earthbender. She'd evidently taken some kind of personal dislike to him, possibly because she seemed to have a particular hatred of Karana, the Fire Ferret's waterbender and a childhood friend of Corwin's, and had blatantly fouled him twice. Now she stood before his table, dressed in civilian clothes with only a faint Fire Nation flavor about them, and glared at him with arms folded across her chest. Taking his first really good look at her, Corwin was mildly surprised to discover that, with her dark hair cropped as if by a prison barber, the willfully undecorative patch over her left eye, and her perpetual glower, she was effectively compensating for the fact that she was really not a bad-looking woman. The silence stretched awkwardly for a moment. Zanya didn't seem to be looking for a fight. They were in a very public place, after all, and Major League Bending had very strict rules about that sort of thing. She just stood there, regarding him with a sort of neutral hostility, until finally he decided someone had to say something and asked, Can I help you? Zanya kept her glower fixed on him for a moment. Then, surprising him again, she sighed, dropping her arms to her sides. I don't know, she said. Can I sit down? Corwin gestured to the seat Rohan had vacated. "Please," he said. As she seated herself, his natural hospitability kicked in, such that even though he had no reason to suspect her of any friendly intent, he automatically asked, "Have you eaten? The maguro is excellent today." Sonya eyed him narrowly. "Are you for real?" she asked. "I'm no more than 25% imaginary," Corwin assured her. Looking more closely, he saw the dark circle around her one visible eye and her generally worn appearance, then added, "You look like you've got something pretty heavy on your mind." "You could say that," she replied sourly. "Well, there's no sense dealing with it on an empty stomach, whatever it is," said Corwin pragmatically, signaling for the waiter. Sonya protested, but only half-heartedly, and when he went away again, it was with a substantial order in hand. "So," said Corwin, "what's up? I would have thought you'd be back in Frostbite Point by now. Don't you have preseason training to do?" Sonya sat looking at her knuckles for a minute, as if gathering her thoughts, or possibly mustering her courage. Then, looking up at his face, she said, "The ice wraiths are finished." Corwin arched an eyebrow. "Oh?" "Well, Casa still owns the name, and he might put another team together under it," she allowed. "But Rockalanch and I both quit after our match against the ferrets." "Hmm," said Corwin. "I can see why he would have. He was plainly what they call not a good fit for the organization," he went on dryly. "But you..." Sonya sighed, slumping back in her seat. "I know, but..." She looked up at the ceiling for a second. "I'm not sure I can put it into words. I'm not sure why I even want to put it into words." Fixing him with a one-sided amber gaze, she asked him in all evident seriousness, "Are you a witch doctor or something?" "Well, not as such," Corwin said, then added, "I've certainly made no effort to bewitch you." Suddenly animated, Sonya leaned forward, her elbows on the table, and said intently, "Look, all my life I've had to fight for what I had, you understand? I wasn't a little rich girl like Azana, or a scholarship kid like Karana, and I didn't lie down for it either. I earned everything I've ever had in my life with my fists. In my world there were two kinds of people, victims and victors. Kindness was either weakness or a ruse to get your guard down. To survive, let alone come out on top, I had to strike first, always." "I'm sorry to hear that," said Corwin sincerely. "I think you really are," Sonya replied. Then she put her forehead in her hands and groaned. "And it's messing with my head." "Oh, come on," said Corwin sharply, making her glance up at him in faint shock. "You're what, 20, 25? I cannot possibly be the first nice person you've ever met. In fact, I know I'm not. I can think of at least three you met before me." "Maybe," Sonya allowed. "But you're the first one I can remember really believing in. And now I can't help wondering if I was wrong about the others." She shook her head. "You don't understand. There was never any place in my world for doubt. I knew, that I was only doing unto others before they got the chance to do unto me. But then you came along. You and the ferret girls, you'd never worked together before, and you were making the most pathetic rookie mistakes." "Thank you," Corwin put in dryly. "Well, you were. And then, the three of you, you just turned it around. Turned it right around and whipped the three of us like we were kids on a playground. I didn't even go home that night. I just walked around and around the city, trying to figure out how you had done it."
At first I assumed you had cheated. Because I would have. Because that's how the world works, right? Except however I turned it around in my head, I couldn't work out how you could have done it. Sometime around dawn, I finally realized that you hadn't, she admitted, sounding strangely crushed by the realization. You three had just beaten us. You got hold of yourselves and came together as a unit without any practice or training because you trusted each other. We could never do that. Casa and I worked together for years, but we never trusted each other. We were just reasonably confident that we had more to lose than gain by turning on each other. And Rockalanch, well, you saw. The waiter arrived with her order then. Only when he had laid it out before her and withdrawn did Zanya continue speaking, in the hushed and vaguely awed voice of someone who has just recognized a great and terrible truth. You didn't beat us by being better benders. You beat us by being better people. Corwin frankly thought that might be overselling the issue a bit, but he was hardly going to split that hair. She did have a point, and at the moment he couldn't grudge her a little hyperbole. Instead, he said nothing, only made a noncommittal grunt, covering his lack of a response by taking a drink of water. She didn't seem to be expecting one anyway. She sat looking at her food as though not certain what she was supposed to do with it, then began to eat mechanically. Like a hospital patient who has little interest in food, but has been ordered by her doctor to get some on board. After a few minutes of this, she put down her chopsticks and asked him abruptly, "Who are you?" Corwin looked up from his own meal and smiled slightly. "Everyone seems to want to know that lately," he said. "Please don't play games with me right now," Zanya told him, surprising him yet again with her use of please. "I need to know. You're obviously a foreigner, and you bend Earth like no one I've ever seen before. Where did you come from? Where does Karana know you from? Who are you?" she repeated, now sounding slightly desperate. Corwin considered her for a second, then said, "Okay, I'll tell you. But you might not believe me, and I want to ask you something in return." Zanya hesitated, but only for a moment. Then she nodded, looking determined, and said, "Okay, anything you want to know. Just tell me who you are. Maybe if I know that, I'll be able to figure out how you were able to turn my whole world upside down." So Corwin told her. Not the complete and unexpurgated version, because that would have required complicated adjustments to her cosmic Weltanschauung he simply didn't have time to make, but the version that included his being from the big universe, and his lifelong association with Avatar Korra, anyway. Zanya took it all in, not interrupting, and then sat in thoughtful silence for a few moments after he'd finished, picking at her food. Then she said slowly, "You're right, that's hard to believe. But then I've had trouble believing a lot of stuff that's gone through my head since Tuesday night." She sighed, a long, deep sigh, and looked glumly at the table again. "I don't know what to think. For the first time in my life, I don't know what to think." Then she looked up and said, "All right, you answered my question. What I do with the answer is my own problem. Your turn." Corwin looked thoughtfully back at her for a second. She probably expected him to request more information about the difficulties of her childhood, or to investigate further her behavior in the bending arena. Instead, he asked her point blank, "Why do you cover your left eye? I know it works." Zanya went pale and actually drew back slightly, her uncovered eye going wide and its pupil contracting with shock. For a moment she looked like she might bolt, Then she got hold of herself with a visible effort, clenching her fists on the edge of the table and reining herself in. "No," she said quietly, as if to herself. "A deal's a deal." Then, looking him in the face, she said, "But you've got to promise me you won't tell anyone. No one knows about this, not even Casa." Corwin nodded gravely. "Done." Looking slightly afraid now, Zanya glanced furtively around the restaurant. The lunch rush was over now. Empty tables had appeared all around the dining room, and none of the others near the corner where Corwin sat was occupied. Only a couple of the staff were in sight, and they were off tending to other matters. They were as alone as they could get in a public place. Moving slowly, almost as if unwillingly, she reached up and lifted the patch away from her left eye, flipping it up onto her forehead. This revealed the fine mesh, much more obvious on the inside, that made it so she could see out with it in place. Then, after steeling herself, she raised her face and looked him in the eyes with both of hers. The right one, as he had noticed before, was that distinctive amber-brown color, bordering on orange, that was stereotypical of firebenders. And the left was a clear, bright blue, not too unlike his own. Corwin looked momentarily confused. "Why would you hide that?" he wondered. "It's beautiful." Zanya blushed flame red. It might have been the first time she'd ever been complimented on anything other than her ruthlessness or her bending technique, and hurriedly snapped the patch down, covering her blue eye again. "My mother came from an old Fire Nation family," she said, her voice hushed and hoarse. "Maybe even older than Azana's. So did her husband." She let that sink in for a second, then added with cold emphasis, "Obviously my father didn't." "Ah," said Corwin, and then, "That's hardly your fault." "Apparently my mother's people disagreed," said Zanya with a bitter smirk. "She might have gotten away with it. I turned out pale and black-haired like her, but the eye gave her away. They sent her to a sanatorium and me to an orphanage in the north. Not Fire Nation enough for my mother's family, but to the other kids there I was... Well, I won't trouble you with the details." "It's no trouble," said Corwin, and he was faintly surprised to discover that he meant it. Why his heart should go out to this willfully unpleasant creature he wasn't entirely sure, but there it was. She reminded him a little of Liza Broadbank, in that brittle and precarious time before she had gone away and become Liza Shustal, Scourge of the Spaceways. With Zanya there was that same sense that her malformations of character might not entirely be her fault, and that she could go a number of different ways from here, not all of which boded well for her future. He still wasn't attracted to her. He'd never had a thing for bad girls. But he did feel an undeniable compassion now. "Look," she said, though there was little heat in it, "don't try to be my buddy all of a sudden. I didn't come here hoping you could fix me. It was just an impulse. I saw you, and I wanted to try and find out how you got inside my head so easily. But I still don't know. This was a waste of time." She got up from the table. "Thanks for lunch. If I find out you told anyone what I just showed you, I'll kill you." "Zanya," he said, but she left without looking back. A few moments later, Rohan reappeared, seating himself and pushing the remains of Zanya's lunch discreetly aside. "Since the restaurant isn't on fire," he said dryly, "I'm going to guess that went relatively well. What did she want?" "I'm not really sure," Corwin admitted after a few seconds' thought. "Maybe just someone to talk to."
After making certain Mogi had been unsaddled and returned to the bison caves when Utna and company got in, which of course he had, Corwin poked around the island a bit, but found no sign of Nall. He would have liked to get the dragon's take on the strange conversation he'd had over lunch. Besides which, he knew they would have to discuss his confrontation with Lakpa sooner or later. He'd been hoping to get to it before Nall had a chance to hear about it from her and form a solid opinion, but it was what it was. Truth to tell, he was a bit weary of the whole business anyway, so he gave up after a single sweep around the dragon's usual haunts on the island and returned to the house instead. There he found Utna and Anthy under Jinora's supervision in the front room, experimenting some more with the length of silk that had so summarily defeated him that morning. Not very to his surprise, it seemed Utna had decided to attempt the alternate configuration Jinora had described as an advanced technique, though at the point in the process where Corwin came in, she appeared to be regretting her rashness very slightly. "You're spotting me, right? I don't want to drop her," she said, glancing hesitantly back over her shoulder at Anthy. Anthy nodded. "Of course I am. We're not terribly practiced at this yet, any of us." "Oh, I can't watch," said Garnet, but she kept watching. "Relax, Garnet. Nothing will go wrong. Have faith," said Jinora sagely. "Okay, here goes then." Utna tucked the fabric up, looping one end over her back and shoulder and the other around Annabelle and her own chest. She bent down and, with Anthy's help, scooted the baby high up onto her back, keeping the fabric as taut as she dared. "You can snug it tighter, dear," Anthy said from behind her. "She doesn't seem to mind." Utna glanced at Jinora, who nodded slightly with a little smile. Thus reassured, she pulled the sash's long edges, rails, to use Jinora's word, more, until the fabric felt like it didn't have any more give. "Corwin, give her a hand with the next part, won't you? While Anthy keeps everything steady," Jinora prompted. Under her direction, they got everything wrapped up and tied securely, using a general technique very like the one she'd learned that morning. With everything folded and knotted just so, Utna found that Annabelle was situated neatly between her shoulder blades, with the child's head resting on her, Utna's, shoulder, and the whole rig felt snug and tight and very, very well balanced. "Say," she said, "that's not bad." After walking around in a little circle and testing the range of her shoulders, largely unimpeded, she tried an experimental lunge. Annabelle made a faint noise of approval, squirmed just slightly, and hiccuped. "I think I could probably even spar wearing her like this," said Utna, blinking in surprise at Anthy. "Wow, this is actually pretty comfortable." "I'm pretty sure she'd enjoy it if you did, actually," Corwin said, then grinned. "I'm told I loved bouncing around on Mom's back while she was training with the Valkyrie back in the day." "Somehow I'm not surprised," Anthy said wryly. "Once you're more used to her, love, by all means, wear her through your workouts. As she grows, you'll get some extra leg strength from the added weight. And as long as you don't think she'll slip, she should be fine."
"I'll check with Caitlin," Utna agreed. "She can keep an eye on her, too, and we can stop if anything slips."
She tried another lunge, deeper this time, and laughed at the cheerful sound it elicited from the baby. "You like that, eh?" she said, turning her head to catch Annabelle's face in the corner of her eye. "Want to go for a little run? Maybe check out the view from the meditation pavilion? Come on, Corwin, you can spot me. Let's give this rig a proper test."
"Not without me, you don't," Garnet objected, darting after them.
This from a woman who said yesterday that she wasn't sure how to react, Jinora observed dryly when the four had gone. "That's our Utna," said Anthy with a smile. "Her engine room telegraph has only one setting, damn the torpedoes. Janora nodded. Yes. I begin to understand why she and Korra have taken to one another so quickly.